Case number 22-3068, United States of America versus Salustio Lutimila, also known as Salu Lutimila, also known as Lutimila Salu Lanzo, appellant. Ms. Batty for the appellant, Ms. Kelly for the appellant.
Good morning, counsel. Ms. Batty, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, may it please the court. It's Rabati from the Federal Defender's Office for Mr. Salustio and Lutimila. With me at counsel table is Tony Axel, who has entered an appearance. Mr. Lutimila was sentenced pursuant to guideline 2B1.1, which enhances the defendant's offense level based on the amount of, quote, loss. That term is undefined in the guidelines, but the guidelines commentary directs courts to apply the greater of, quote, intended loss or, quote, actual loss. That is what the district court did here when it used an intended loss figure of $610,000 in the 2B1.1 loss table calculation, rather than the amount that the victim actually lost, which was $76,069.
So why should the court give a defendant who's been charged with a particular crime the benefit of essentially collateral help when the money has been returned to a certain extent, as opposed to what they intended to rob somebody of, or in this case, what they actually stole?
So that comes from the plain text of the word loss. And it's important to realize here that in 2B1.1, out of the 20 special offense characteristics, this is the only one that does not use the word the offense. It uses the word loss. It doesn't use the amount taken. Again, it uses the word loss. And loss, the plain meaning of that term, is the amount that the victim actually lost. And that comes from the dictionary definitions that the Third Circuit and the Sixth Circuit cited to. It also comes from the what a reasonable person would understand from that term. And
we know temporally how when to measure loss. I might lose my keys this morning, I might find them later in the day, but that doesn't change the fact that they were lost.
Right, Your Honor. And again, we're asking the word loss at the time of sentencing. No one's asking that word, at the time of indictment. When we're writing, when the PSR is being written by the probation officer or the judge is sitting down to sentence the defendant, that's when we're asking the term loss.
Why is that the perfect time? I mean, someone could be physically injured, they could be beaten up, and they were injured at the time of the offense. By the time of sentencing, it could be years later, they're not injured.
Right, and we recognize when we assign this calculation to happen at the time of sentencing, we realize what we always realize about sentencing, which is that is the time when the judge has the most perfect information he is going to get, and he's able to account for relevant situational factors that are critical for implementing the guideline as written. And that's why, for example,
you have a probation officer potentially saying that you owe restitution. And many defendants will try to get that restitution paid before they come to court. So the defense counsel can be very strategic about when the sentencing actually occurs by asking for different continuances, asking the ability to pay the restitution, and so then loss is lower.
Right, Your Honor is correct. But that's where the sentencing judge has that discretion, for example, to vary outside, using the 3553 factors, or to use his discretion to both implement the guideline as written, but then also use his ability to vary. And it's important to realize that this is the policy call that the commission made, right? To use loss and by using loss to make that calculation, incorporating any offsetting amounts, incorporating any recovered amounts at the time of sentencing. If the commission wished to make a different policy call, that policy call is their choice, and they can do that, but they can't do that in the commentary. They must do that in the guideline. And I wanted to also,
So I based on this line of argument, I'm not quite understanding why we care about the commentary for the following reason: that if you think that actual loss just means actual net loss at the time of sentencing, and that seems to me what you think the plain meaning of loss is, then why do we care about the difference between actual loss and intended loss? Because intended loss just doesn't figure into it at all under that formulation. It's just kind of, so the commentary that talks about the possibility of taking the greater of actual loss and intended loss is just beside them. It has nothing to do with this case at all.
Well, the commentary, you're right that the loss, the plain meaning of the term loss is the amount that the victim actually suffered. And that will necessarily incorporate any recovered amounts, any offsets.
That's what you're reading. That may not be right. I guess what I'm saying is, if we assume that that's your view, then what does the commentary about intended loss have to do with it? Because as I understand the concept of intended loss, that doesn't have to do with the difference between what was initially the loss and then was late lost at some point later after it's not recovered. Intended loss just doesn't have to do with that.
Well, intended loss or attempted loss, typically, you know, judges use that term to look at what the defendant originally intended, right? So in this case, for example, it's the $610,000. And that's obviously what is straightforward from the commentary and what judges typically apply in terms of calculating the guidelines range. Now here, actual loss in terms of what the victim actually suffered is, Your Honor is correct, that is the amount calculated at sentencing that incorporates any recovered amounts. You do not, I guess, need the commentary to arrive at that.
That's your position on actual loss. Okay. The last thing is, whatever the right answer on actual loss means, it could either be what was lost at the beginning or what was ultimately lost counting recovery by the time of sentence. That's the debate. But that debate just doesn't have anything to do with intended loss.
It has to do with intended loss only to the extent that intended loss was used by the judge, obviously in this case, as the amount that you wish to implement into the guidelines range. Now, obviously,
$610,000 was the actual loss.
It was not the actual loss.
It
was the amount taken in this case, but okay. It wasn't the actual loss because, again, we're asking that question at sentencing.
No, again, you're to go with Chief Judge Scrimshaw-Dotson, you're kind of defining this based on your definition of actual loss, but there could be other perspectives.
It's not my definition. It's the common sense understanding, the ordinary plain meaning of the term loss, which, again, as the Third Circuit and the Sixth Circuit said, has nothing to do with what the defendant intended to take. But it's actually what the victim actually lost.
We've been sentencing for a long time. I know myself and Judge Wilkins, because we were on the federal trial court, we've had lots of cases where it's intended loss. For example, I've had cases where you have a tax situation and you are the tax preparer and you're doing all these types of deductions or credits, et cetera, to allow somebody to get a bigger return. That gets caught over in, let's say, IRS center in Dallas or somewhere like that. And so the fact that it got stopped, it doesn't mean that you didn't intend for those people to get all that money back and intend to rob the IRS of those funds. It happens in government contracting schemes too. If you overbid and you try to get money in that regard too, about what you overcontract and over subscribe to what you should actually get paid and things of that nature. So there's a reason for intended loss from the standpoint of what's your mental intention with respect to the crime. And so that's why those terms seem to be distinguished out, because you should not get credit. And that's what the district court wrestled with. You should not get credit from the fact that somebody else paid it. Even if your mother paid your fine or your fee or whatever your probation restitution loss was, that there seems to be at least some sense that you don't get credit for the crime.
So, Your Honor, again, we're looking at the term loss as it's written in this guideline. And I'll just point out again that the sentencing, the specific offense characteristics that are used to hike up the defendant's offense level for this guideline use the word the offense every one of the 20 times that SOCs are used. But for this SOC, there's one word used, and it's loss. It's not amount taken. It's not the offense. It's loss. And loss carries the plain meaning of the amount the victim actually suffered. And let me give you an example.
You have a forfeiture problem. Standard of review. It's plain error. It's the defense agreed. I'm looking specifically at 2 Appendix 76, the defense said as set forth in the pre-sentence report, the applicable sentencing guideline range is 51 months. And articulated for a 12-month, one-day sentence as a variance. And I didn't see anything at the sentencing hearing that changed that. And as a district judge, the first thing you're supposed to do is calculate the guidelines and determine whether either side has an objection to the guidelines calculation, and then resolve that objection, because then you have to deal with departures and all of that, and then you go on to the 3553A factors. We can't have a situation where defense counsel says that the guidelines calculation is correct in the district court, and then comes to the Court of Appeals and says, no, actually, it wasn't correct. And that seems like what we have here.
Your Honor, that's not correct, because on Joint Appendix 134, defense counsel stated specifically that what Mr. Lugamila had a problem with was the actual offense level calculation. It was not whether the court should vary, but whether
that's the defense, not the language that 134 I'm looking at.
It's she said what should be measured is the actual loss, that 76,069, and that's where we get the 7 plus the 6. So she identifies the six points as the enhancement from the loss table that should be applied, rather than the 14 points that the PSR identified. And that is an objection. She's informing the court that she thinks that the court should be using 6 points as its enhancement for the 2B1.1 loss table. And that's what the court, that's what Rule 51 requires, simply informing the court of the action that the defendant wishes the court to make.
13, you don't even get a guideline.
I'm sorry?
But that doesn't even compute, because at 13, you don't get a guideline for 12, 18 months. It's like 3 months, opinions. And then the court later says, so everyone agrees that the guideline range is 51 to 63 months, whatever it is. And there's no objection to that at all.
Well, I think the objection is here on 134, where she identifies, again, she informs the court that she objects to the loss amount. Well, she's clarifying, again, you don't have to use any particular words. That's what this court held in Abney. What she's doing is she's informing the court of the action that she wishes the court to take, or that Mr. Lugamila wishes the court to take, which is to use the $76,000 figure to in the loss table, and that would result in the quote 7 plus the 6. That's 6 points right there. That's the enhancement that she thinks that the court should arrive at by using the $76,000 figure in the loss table. And again, the threshold from Abney is low. That's what this court said in Brock. It's a very low threshold. It's a straightforward.
But this is a specific context of sentence. In Gaul, all of the Supreme Court cases, post Booker and Fanning, would say that guidelines are rising. Still say that our job on appeal, our first job is to ensure that there's no procedural error. And it translates is to ensure that there's no procedural error and that they calculate the guidelines correctly. The judge here is a very experienced judge, former federal prosecutor. They didn't pick up that there was an objection to the guidelines calculation here. I wouldn't have. The whole point of the plain error rule is that we're supposed to, yes, we don't put our magic words, but you got to read, especially if you have written that the guidelines calculation of the PSR is correct. You've got to at least bring it sufficiently to the district court's attention that, oh, actually, it's not correct. I shouldn't have said it.
I think Your Honor is is right that this is a very experienced judge. Judge Boasberg is extremely experienced, and I think he recognized that this, and he did, in fact, when he states later on that, you know, I don't agree that this is the number I should focus on. He recognizes that she is objecting to the guidelines range, and that's why he states that later on. And so, again, the amount, the actual loss. I don't think so. I mean, she says 7 plus the 6, which means she's looking directly at the guidelines range calculation, the offense level calculation under 2B1.1 law, for the loss table there. She's not looking, she's not making a variance.
If you have 7 plus 6, which you would guidelines range be 12 to 18 months,
so she did, she also said later on that I think I missed, you know, I didn't add the levels for the level I missed adding. She says that on 137. So she corrects her guidelines calculation there. But she the point is here, she's saying that the offense, the enhancement from 2B1.1 should be the 6. She is putting that on the record, and she is informing the court that that is what the enhancement should be from the 2B1.1 loss table. And it should be that because of the $76,000 figure that should be used. And she identifies that it's actual loss. And again, the term actual loss only comes from the commentary. I mean, Judge Boasberg, again, very experienced judge, knows that actual loss comes from the commentary, and that's how the PSR got to the 610, because it's applying the greater of $610,000 or $76,000.
Well, discuss why you can't look to the commentary.
I'm sorry?
Discuss why we couldn't look to the commentary. Number one, it doesn't necessarily show that the district court did, because it's not mentioned specifically, like the word commentary, and I'm looking at it and there's a definition. But even if they did, tell me what your position about why they couldn't have
done. Why not? Because the commentary conflicts with the plain meaning of the word loss. So again, the plain meaning of the word loss is the amount the victim actually lost, and that must incorporate any offsets or recouped amounts until the time of sentence.
And you're just relying on other circuit precedent for that, nothing in this circuit law Supreme Court.
I'm relying on the Supreme Court's decision in Kyler, which said we have to look directly at the plain text of the guidelines, of a legislative rule, but by analogy through Stinson, of the guidelines text.
Should we also consider Stinson?
Well, Pyker clarified and narrowed Stinson, and it did so by saying we must start with the plain text, and if that text is unambiguous, as it is here, we don't need to go any further.
But when you say loss, and then you have a commentary that says actual loss versus intended loss, how am I to believe that the text is clear?
The text is
clear. You seem to be defining it, and the definition is not there.
So as the court knows, we apply the guidelines as written. And when the term loss is undefined, and the term loss, because it's undefined, we look typically to the dictionary definitions. And those definitions mean unambiguously that loss is the amount loss. As Judge Murphy's...
But the 610 is what was stolen. So you seem to be further giving it almost like a sub-definition.
So the dictionary definitions comport with what, and they reflect what a reasonable person would understand, what common sense would understand. And let me just give you an example that might kind of drive this home. Imagine that you're walking down the street with two $50 bills, and a pickpocket takes both those $50 bills. And as he's running away and you're running after him, he drops one, and you put that $50 back in your pocket. If your friend asks you what's the loss, any reasonable person would say $50. No one would say $100, right? And that is what's happening here. The victim got $533,000 back. The loss, by plain meaning of the word, is the $76,000. And that, again, it comes from the dictionary definitions, but also from common sense. And that's what the Sixth Circuit has recognized straight from the dictionary in Riccardi and in Smith. And it said that there's nothing in the dictionary definitions that's even close to intended loss. It's also what the Third Circuit recognized in banks.
When loss is calculated, what does case law say about time value of money and interest? Do we add interest so that if $1 million was stolen and it was 3 years ago, that have been invested in the stock market and it could be, you know, $1.5 million or something, you wouldn't be arguing that that we look at loss as of the time of sentencing. You would be arguing your client that we would look at loss at the time of that.
No, I mean, so the again, we're saying this is a calculation that must happen at the time of sentencing. And like any actual loss calculation, that can incorporate various factors. It could incorporate an opportunity cost if it was, you know, that type of calculation is a rigorous calculation. And we know this, you know, in the restitution context where we, again, can do an actual loss calculation at the time of sentencing. It could incorporate different factors. Here, obviously, it's very straightforward. The actual loss here was $76,000and $76,069. That was straightforward because that is the amount, you know, $610,000 minus the $533,000 that was recouped. So it's straightforward in this case, and that's what we think, you know, this court should, the district court should have used, is that $76,000.
$76,000. Make sure my colleagues don't have any questions for you at this time, and I'll give you a little time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Let it from the government now.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Catherine Kelly on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, in this case, first of all, Mr. Ludmilla has waived his claim that the district court committed procedural error in calculating the loss amount under 2B1.1. He didn't just fail to raise this challenge in the district court. He specifically agreed in his sentencing memo, and I quote, as set forth in the PSR, the applicable sentencing guidelines range is 51 to 63 months based on a zero criminal history points and offense level of 24, which included a 14-level increase in this case for a $610,000 loss amount. For that reason, we don't believe the court should even address this case. If the court is to address it, however, we would have plain error.
Do you think the way waiver and plain error intersect is that if you assert waiver, do we have to address whether there was waiver, or can we just say, and let's just assume for argument purposes that you're going to prevail on a plain error, just so I can understand conceptually how this fits together. Is the government's perspective that, well, because you've asserted waiver, because there's a factual grounding for potentially finding waiver, that we actually have to decide whether there's waiver or not, or does the court have the ability to just assume away the waiver question and engage in plain error?
It's my understanding the court could, in its discretion, still, if the claims waived, choose to entertain a claim.
Even for waiver?
We would say do not, but in my experience, it has been, I've seen courts say, if it's waived, you can still use our discretion and review this question, at least under the plain error review standard, which if the court, and we would still say, though, in this case, that it is an actual waiver because it wasn't just a matter of forfeiting a claim. Here, the defense counsel actually said, in its sentencing memo, we agree that the calculation of the loss amount is correct because they were saying that the sentencing range was in fact calculated correctly. And it's very clear that the argument the defense counsel was making in its sentencing memo is that fine, the guidelines range is correct here, but we would like you to vary from that guidelines range very downward to a sentence of 12 months and one day, based on the fact in the sentencing memo, she was claiming that she wanted that variance mainly in light of Mr. Ludmilla's history and characteristics and his family needs. She went on to explain, and this is what's different between our argument and the defense argument. Mr. Ludmilla at the sentencing hearing did not, in fact, then create a new issue and say, no, in fact, I do think that the loss amount calculation that set the guidelines range is wrong, and it should be lower. What the defense counsel said there was that, first of all, the court should use the term the court should deviate from guidelines, And then and she actually said that she wanted to explain her request for a 12-month and one-day sentence. And that's when defense counsel got into the argument that really the amount that should be measured here is what she was calling the actual loss. And she was saying that that was the $76,000. And then she analogized to that being a 12 to 18 month range if you looked at the applicable to be 1.1 loss table.
She uses the words base offense level.
Yes, base offense level on page 134.
Yeah.
She said that that's a 7, and then she added 6 additional levels for an amount that would correspond on the loss table to $76,000.
I'm talking about base offense levels and what they should be calculating that. I mean, that's the guidelines calculation exercise, not a variance.
It is an application of the loss table in 2B1.1. However, defense counsel started that point in her argument saying, I realized that I didn't lay out my sentencing memo why or how we got to the 12-month and one-day request, which was, of course, a variance request in the plain language of her sentencing memo. So essentially what counsel was doing was saying that the court should vary to a lower sentence to put the defendant in a place that he would be had he actually only stolen $76,000. But that's not what happened here. Everybody agreed, and I believe we still agree today, that Mr. Ludmilla, in fact, stole $610,000. And he should not be given a windfall for the fact that through no help from him, by the time of sentencing, the credit union, with help from E-Trade, was able to recoup approximately $533,000 of that money.
Well, what's your response to the argument that was put forward earlier to the effect that if a pickpocket takes $250 and then drops one, Not about stolen, because I think you're right, everybody does agree with stolen. It's hard to see what the speaking of that, but in terms of the losses.
The loss is the loss to the victim, which is, in fact, if unless the victim picks that right up off the sidewalk, he has still lost $100. Whether or not the defendant ends up holding on to both $50 bills is not really the issue. And it's certainly not the issue in any realm how much the victim got back by the time the defendant was sentenced. We pointed out the Merriman case in our brief in particular, and that case makes clear that the purpose of a loss calculation under the sentencing guidelines is to, in the fraud situation under 2B1.1, is to measure the magnitude of the crime at the time the offense happens, which is what the court was doing here by saying the offense level is the extra 14 levels based on $610,000. That's correct. And Merriman then went on to say the fact that a victim has recovered part of the money they lost by the time of sentencing doesn't have any bearing on a 2B1.1 calculation because it doesn't diminish the defendant's culpability in any way. And of course, the court would be free to look at the guidelines commentary here, and that fits exactly into note 3E of the commentary, which does, in some very narrow circumstances, give a defendant credits towards the loss amount, but those don't fit here. It only gives credit to a defendant for the victim recouping some loss amount if, first of all, the defendant had some hand in returning that money. That did not happen here. IDB and E-Trade did this completely on their own with no help from Mr. Ludmilla. And if that money is recouped by the victim at some point before the crime is discovered, what we have here is Mr. Ludmilla stealing $610,000 by in full January of 2019. IDB, the credit union, discovered this loss in April of 2019 when they hired a new CFO. And it was after that that they were able to recoup the $533,000 from E-Trade. So that's, again, no help from the defendant and after the crime was discovered. So even if we do look at the guidelines commentary, it just doesn't fit here. I think it's quite clear, though, that loss, since everybody agrees it's not defined in the text, this is not a situation where the term loss is unambiguous. The defendant hasn't cited any cases where loss is the amount of money a victim has recovered. It takes out rather the amount of money that a victim has recovered at the time of sentencing. There's simply no case law that supports that. And in fact, there isn't any case law that defendants support saying that loss as a general matter should just be addressed as what that amount was at the time of the sentencing.
Are you taking the position that the guideline, what is that commentary, that the guideline unambiguously favors the government on whether you take into account recovery by the time of sentencing? Or are you saying it's ambiguous? So look at the commentary. The commentary makes clear that it's only when the defendant is recovered.
I'm just saying that the term loss is ambiguous in the text of the text.
The term loss in the guideline unambiguously rejects the position being put forward by the defendant.
I would say, first of all, that the loss is not defined, as the defendant agrees, by the text. It just says the word loss, no definition whatsoever. I would say that there is no correlation between what the defense counsel is saying is the plain meaning of loss. My understanding is defense counsel is arguing that the term actual loss means the amount of money the victim still had not recouped by the time of sentencing. And there's no support for that definition either in the text of the guideline or in the commentary for the guideline. And that if the court were to look at the court's, or to look at the commentary of the guideline, it's completely unsupported by that commentary, particularly note 3 that I've just mentioned. I think one of the main things, and again, getting back to the plain error point, though, is that certainly the court was not understanding any of this to be an argument about the loss calculation in sentencing guidelines range being incorrect, because it said after defense argument and after Mr. Ludmilla spoke, the first thing the court said was, so everybody agrees that the sentencing range is 51 to 63 months. So there is no exercise being done by the court here that is indicating that the court is accepting its theory, the theory put forward by the defense. There's no information in the record or in the court's ruling that shows that the court was thinking of intended loss here at all. So that argument simply does not fit. Court didn't use the word intended loss. In ruling on that very narrow variance of explanation that defense counsel made at the time of the sentencing hearing, the court said, I don't agree that the $76,000 is the right amount, because that would equate somebody who stole a lot of money and was fortunately caught with somebody who stole a lesser amount of money. So he's really talking about how much was stolen and was correctly focused on what the offense conduct was, not what the victim recovered by the time of sentencing. And we believe the court should affirm that decision.
And how does Kaiser fit into your framing? Because it suggests that courts can use traditional means of construction to resolve that appeal. But are you just, you know, I just want to know if we should be commenting on that particular analysis.
I don't believe you need to get to Kaiser here, because it's not clear that the court was looking at the commentary. The court didn't say anything about the commentary in its ruling. I think, frankly, it was just making a very common sense decision that you look at the offense that has occurred. You don't look at what the victim's position is at the time of sentencing, in ruling that the $76,000 was not the number that it should examine in determining the sentence here. Or frankly, in accepting the argument, the variance argument, that the defendant's sentence should be set downward to 12 months and a day. So there's really no reason to look at Kaiser here. If the court were to look at Kaiser here, it's just important to note that Kaiser does not hold that the court has to ignore the guidelines commentary. It only says that you look to see whether or not a particular guideline should receive our deference. And in doing that, the first thing you do is to say, do you get our deference? The first thing the court would look at is to say, is this particular guideline ambiguous? We would say the term loss since it's undefined, as everybody agrees, it's ambiguous insofar as it is not clearly creating the definition that defense counsel would like it to have today.
Make sure my colleagues will have additional questions for you.
Thank you, Your Honor. We respectfully request that you affirm the judgment.
So I think we'll be a few minutes for it all.
Yeah. So I want to start with what the government is saying about the definition being ambiguous. That is simply not the case. The definition of loss is clearly unambiguous, and that follows, you know, from common sense. The government seems to live in some kind of parallel universe where the amount taken is a definition of loss, and that is not the case. That follows again from the dictionary definition, which defines loss as the amount the victim actually lost. It's not the same as the amount taken. And the other point is, again, the guidelines themselves use the word the offense in all 20 of the SOCs except this one. This one uses the word loss. And I don't think the government has come to grips with that. That is not, the government is citing over and over, you know, this is, we have to look at the offense itself. That's not what this loss table is asking this court, the district court to do. It's asking the district court to look at the term, at the word loss, and what that means is the amount that the victim actually lost. The other point is, under Kaiser, you can't look to purpose and can't look to commentary to create ambiguity in a guideline that's otherwise unambiguous. And that's, again, what the government's seeking to do by looking at Note 3E. It's also looking at the purpose statement in the background. That is not permissible under Kaiser. The government also claims that there's no case law that says that you look to the net detriment of the victim. There's actually a line of cases that say very clearly that in situations dealing with fortuitous recovery, the net detriment of the victim is estimated at the time of sentencing. And that's the amount that the victim actually lost. So that's United States v. Johnson, 16 F3rd 166 from the Seventh Circuit. There's also cases that case cites in the Third Circuit and the Ninth Circuit as well. And as for the preservation argument, obviously this was not exactly the most artful objection, but clearly it was not waived. It was not even forfeited because the district court actually considered the argument and passed on the argument. And there's nothing in this court's precedent that says that you can't raise an objection at sentencing or even clarify what you said in the sentencing memorandum. That is what defense counsel did here. And lastly, I'd point out that the sentencing guidelines do look at intended loss in the tax guideline 2T1.1. So clearly the guidelines is capable of using and looking and directing courts to intended loss where they mean to. And certainly the guidelines, the commission is able to clean up the guidelines and make a policy call, but it can't do that in the commentary. It has to do that in the guidelines. So yes, part two, making the sentence and remand purposes.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take this case under submission.